This is a production of the Cornell University Library. The following is an audio recording of a lecture given in October 2007 at the John M. Olin Library by Master Bookbinder Peter Verheyen.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everyone to this afternoon's presentation by Peter Verheyen, noted bookbinder and conservator. My name is Michelle Brown, and I'm a member of the Cornell Book Arts Club. I'm also the book conservator here at Cornell. The Cornell Book Arts Club was organized this year in order to promote bookbinding and other arts and crafts related to books produced by hand. We hope to provide a forum for lectures, demonstrations, and workshops. In May, we sponsored a lecture by Catherine Reagan, curator of rare books. At this time, she discussed and showed some of Cornell's bookbinding treasures. In June, we sponsored a paste paper making workshop. We hope to sponsor more workshops in the upcoming months. The Cornell Book Arts Club is open to all members of the Ithaca and Cornell communities. Today's lecture is also partially funded by the Cornell Council for the Arts. Today we are pleased to present Peter Verheyen. He is currently the Preservation and Digital Access Librarian at Syracuse University, a position he has held since 1995. From 1993 to 1995, he was the book conservator at Cornell. He is also the founder of the Book Arts Listserv, a listserv that supports discussions about bookbinding and related arts, and he is the founder of the Book Arts Web, a website devoted to the book arts. Peter is well known for his fine bindings and work in the bookbinding community. Today, he is going to talk about his training and experience in bookbinding. Please welcome Peter Verheyen.
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you, Buzz, for having me here. Greatly appreciated and fun to be back. As I was preparing for this, I kind of realized that I gave this a version of this talk way back in 1993 when I first came here. So this is the flyer for that I then tacketed all over campus. And what was kind of amusing was I was totally enamored with digital technology, and I went upstairs and I had them digitize it, which is more of what I'm doing now rather than book conservation. But it was kind of fun. So anyway, been here before, done this before. So what I'm going to talk about is basically how I got into bookbinding, my training, my career, and then talk a little bit about my books, and we can talk about those fairly informally, casually, and you're all welcome to come up and handle them, take a look at them, that's what they're there for. That picture is actually pretty funny. That was something that a colleague and I were doing for the Guild of Book Workers from 1970, me and a goat, and there's a lot of goats on this table, so part of this thing. I started out like probably, I don't know, some of the people in the field. I started as a work-study student. I went undergraduate at Johns Hopkins, initially intending to go into law, international law, and like many of us, we needed to work. So my dad said, well, go to the library, but instead of shelving books, you might want to talk to this English guy who works in the basement where there's no windows and tell him you're looking for a job. That English guy was John Dean. And so I got my start with John doing book repair, refurbishing in the collections, making enclosures. But the whole ambiance at the time was really unusual in that Cornell had an apprentice, Johns Hopkins had an apprentice training program based on the English model, which was 7 years. So you had John, who was running the program. There was a paper conservator there, Joanna Mankowski, and a lot of people at different stages in their training. And so even as a work study, I was part of that. And what was really nice was that John, in particular, was incredibly nurturing. And if he saw that you were interested, any of the students, it's like, okay, well, we're having a workshop. Why don't you sit in and watch? Why don't you learn? And so that really opened up my eyes to it. And, it was a lot of work doing it, but it was also a lot of fun. It was really eye-opening in terms of learning about how the field worked, what the kinds of work, the kinds of projects that you might do, conservation treatments, box making, things like that. And for someone like me, the once a twit, always a twit, was a good thing. That was a pin that was awarded by two of the apprentices in the program, Nancy Bell, who's now conservator in the UK, and Nora Liberano, who's a book artist working in New York City, and I was frequently awarded that pin. And it basically meant, you're asking too many questions, you're too eager to do too much, too fast, slow down. But, you know, it was wonderful because all of them, down to the last one, really helped out, really helped me get into this field. So, you know, without them, I wouldn't have been here. As part of my job, you know, I was realizing that maybe I didn't want to go to law school, and I was a semester ahead of myself, and was thinking, okay, what do? I can graduate early, or I can take a semester off. So John was very encouraging in this, and as was Frank Maury, who's a conservator at the Folger Shakespeare Library, who I got to know. And they said, well, why don't you go to Germany and do an internship? If this is something that you're interested in as a possible career, you have the passport, so you won't have problems working there or living there. And, you know, it'll be a new experience. So ended up going to work in the museum conservation lab that you can see the upper right at the Germanisches Nationalmuseum in Nuremberg, which has a really, really rich book binding collection, but also it's German art starting in the Romanesque period and some Bronze Age and Iron Age artifacts, not quite to the contemporary, but certainly to the turn of the century. And across that courtyard from the conservation lab was that binding, which was on display, and it was just the cover. And that's, I believe, a 9th century four Gospels kind of book. And it was interesting. My father had written about it. He's an art historian. And that's what I was kind of looking at, and that's kind of what I wanted to do. But for me, what was very good was that's how I really got introduced to the trade. And when we look at bookbinding here, very, very few people can still learn it as a trade. And trade doesn't have to be, you know, have a negative connotation, you know, but it's a different way of working. If you look at book arts education here, it's usually in the context of self-study, weekend workshops, and if you're lucky, you can go to a program like North Bennett Street in Boston, or if you want to do conservation, the University of Texas at Austin. But there's not a lot of opportunities. And at that time in Germany, the guild system was still very functional, was very powerful in terms of, you know, controlling what was learned, what the steps were after you finish your apprenticeship, and I'll get into that. And so it was a really good opportunity to learn in the trade. And one of the biggest benefits is you really work. You learn on the job. It's repetition over and over and over again. And, you know, as part of that internship, most of what I did was working on my own things, little blank books, and I have some little example of one here, did some marbling, box making. But I also got to work on some older materials from the collection under supervision. And that really got me interested in it. And at the time, if you wanted to go on to do conservation, especially in an institutional context, and a completed apprenticeship was still a prerequisite. They wanted you to be able to understand bookbinding as a trade, you know, all the different structures that you have to learn, how to work with the materials. Then you can learn the finer points of conservation. Yes, in some points that might mean a little bit of re-education, of undoing of bad habits, but they wanted you, you know, they were going to teach you, they don't want to teach you how to pare leather. They want how to teach you how to pare leather a certain way, or, you know, focus on the finer points. That's changed now. Now an apprenticeship is frowned upon. It's going very much to the model that we have here. So after that internship, I came back, finished up my last semester, and had pretty much decided that I think I was going to try to go and become an apprentice, learn the trade over there, and then see, you know, where my career took me. Part of that was also that there really weren't that many opportunities in the U.S. to learn. The Columbia program was still fairly young. Outside of the Johns Hopkins apprenticeship program, which fell apart fairly quickly after John left, which I believe was a year or so after I left. I think he left in 1986 or 87. There was nothing in this country, and, you know, there was no formal training system so that you could have gone to apprentice with an edition binder in Northampton or East Hampton. That simply wasn't an option, really. Most of those are very small shops, and if you did it, it would be pretty much at your own expense, which is still very much the case here. Part of it was also for me, having grown up as German in the United States, but never really having felt American, well, you know, what's it like if I go back? And I learned fairly, well, within a short time, that I really wasn't German either, and still sometimes sitting on the fence. But for me, that was something I needed to do. And an apprenticeship, you know, it was a three-year kind of commitment. That's finite, that's manageable. If it doesn't work, you can always take the skills and you can come back. And then it was also, I was really interested in the medieval, in the guild system. And part of that was to my undoing, but, you know, it was a very different way of learning. And the way, the biggest thing with the apprenticeship system as it existed in Germany, and it's changed a lot since then, is that everybody in the country in a given year took the same exam. So if you were then, after your apprenticeship, the expectation was pretty much get out of here. Go wander, you know, work in other shops, acquire skills, then settle down somewhere. And by having a nationalized test with everybody knew, if I was in North Germany, I could take my scores to the southernmost part and they would know what I'd been tested on. So there was uniformity. So, you know, I came back and it's like, all right, well, how do I find an apprenticeship? How do I find a shop? And, you know, one of the things Frank had said is like, yeah, you want to do this, Frank Maurer, you want to do this. And he had studied at a university in an art program. I found that out after I came back, not before. I thought he had done, and he always sounded like he had done a traditional apprenticeship, but different story. But basically, how do I do that? And when I was in Germany, one of the things I'd done was start looking through the phone books in areas where I had relatives, so I had a built-in support system. Okay, looking up all the numbers for the bindaries and writing down their addresses. Over there, a handwritten cover letter is still in some cases a requirement. So I was handwriting a lot of cover letters, handwrote the resumes too, and if I thought about the photocopier for that, I would have been very happy. But you know, sent out probably about 30, 40 letters, got invitations to four, and most of them said, yeah, can you stop by next week? And it's like, okay, can we do that in maybe 4 weeks so that I can get a reasonably cheap flight because I can't just drop everything and go. But went over and visited those four bindaries. And it was really, I mean, the picture in the bottom is one of the ones that I visited in Trier, which was the Roman capital of Germany, very, very ancient city. And, you know, it's this kind of very dark trade bindery. You know, I wasn't too happy in that place. But that was probably the one where I got the most honest impression of what the work was actually like. And found one in an artist colony in the middle of the Ruhr Valley, which was where my grandparents and some other relatives live. And the Ruhr Valley is kind of like North Jersey, Gary, Indiana. Steel mills, coal refineries, oil refineries, coal mines, all piled on top of each other with farm fields in between. And in the 1920s, this artist colony had been found in the city of Gelsenkirchen, which was right smack in the middle of it. And the person, the master I apprenticed with, had inherited the shop from his parent, father, who was a binder. And you know, it looked nice. It was cheery and showing all this really neat stuff that he was doing. Reality was a little different, but that's okay in retrospect. It seemed a very welcoming kind of environment for me. So, you know, what is an apprenticeship? I mean, does anybody here have any, you know, what would you imagine as part of an apprenticeship? No? Okay. It's very hierarchical. You have a pecking order. You have the master. The master is always right. You have the journeyman. In the case of my apprenticeship, his wife was a journeyman who was working towards her master. And she was in the shop. And the journeyman kind of does a lot of the running, the day-to-day, working with the apprentices and things like that. I mentioned that the skill sets are dictated on a national level. So there's very clear expectations of what you have to learn. Repetition. It's insane amounts of repetition. And basically, an apprenticeship is a job. And so then you start out, and my first week was sweeping the floors, sorting the paper drawers, making end sheets, so you're just folding, and you're spending all day folding. Well, by the end of that week, you don't have to think about how to fold an end sheet anymore when it says we need more. You just do it. And those are really good skills, really good, it really develops a work ethic. It was an apprenticeship, it was a production environment. We were a library bindery for the most part, but we did everything by hand. So we'd do, an average run of library binding would be like 100 volumes a week for effectively 2.5 people doing the work. Spend all day gluing the books, making covers, things like that. And then there was also trade school. And trade school is something that all apprentices have to go to. And trade school is kind of, it's the equalizer. So these are some pictures of the master, Dietmar Klein. That's the shop. He also was very active training future masters, so he offered courses. This is kind of a fun cartoon. It deals more with people in the carpenter's trade. But here's the master, the boss, and there's people looking for an apprenticeship. And, it's basically saying, any complaints? Not quite that easy. So, you start out at the bottom doing a lot of this work. You're also working as part of a team. So what was a lot of, it wasn't always fun, but it was interesting is, you're covering covers or something. Case binding, and some of you know what that is. And he had his daughters. After school, they'd help out in the shop, and they were great. And they'd be feeding the cloth through the glue machine. And every once in a while, he'd just wink at them. They'd feed it through a little bit faster. And it was basically, it was a game. But it was, get going. So you become fluid with what you're doing, because so much of it, as a trade, needs to become second nature. You don't want to think, how do I do my turn-ins? How do I cut my corners? And working in large batches, you got that repetition. After a while, the first book, as you're sewing, you might think, how do I need to sew this? By the time you've done 100, you just do it. So you're developing this fluidity. The blind obedience thing. In the shop, and this is something that, for someone with a college education who had slightly different expectations, the average apprentice back then was generally, the school system in Germany is different, but I don't want to call them a high school dropout, but they kind of had a selection process, let's say 9th, 10th grade, where if you weren't going to go to a university, you would learn a trade. So you'd go off. So you had people, you had to learn about, social studies. That was kind of good. But, the master was always right. So you're learning all these things. You're going to trade school. In the end, it's his name that goes on the finished product. And it doesn't matter if you have a different idea of doing it. You do it that way. And that's very much part of the apprenticeship system. You can learn to question afterwards. But first, you got to learn to do it at least one way and do it right. And that was a little bit hard to always deal with. But in retrospect, it was good. And then you had to keep a journal. And this was something that every apprentice had to keep by law, and it's on a daily basis. What did you do? How many hours did you spend doing it? And then you also have notes in it. So in this lesson here, we're doing account books, and this is something that was used to cut the tabs, alphabetically. And to space them out. I still, how to do stencils with decorated papers. I still refer to this. It's funny, 20 years plus later, I'm still referring to it. And that's kind of nice. And it's important to keep notes. So any of you who are learning, who want to do, bookbinding or any kind of craft, keep lots of notes and keep them. Keep them organized. Trade school. That was trade school. In many respects, was a big equalizer, because in the hand bookbinding trade, you had people in my situation. I would say I was in a very fortunate situation, being a small shop where we really did everything by hand. Everybody got to do more or less everything at some point. There were people in my trade school class who were also in a hand bindery, which in their context meant they were working a stapler binding magazines every day. And then, you know, you come up close to examination time, the master would say, okay, this is what you have to learn. Let's try to do it real fast. Let's try to teach it to you. Trade school was the equalizer. Trade school is where you really learned a lot of things that you might not learn in your shop on a day-to-day basis. And part of that was also, because it was a trade, you got to play with the really big toys. And for me, that was a lot of fun. You know, there's, even in hand binding, there's equipment. So we had, you know, a guillotine blade, which can cut through a stack of paper like this. That's about, you know, 2 meters long, so a little over 6 feet. And you have to change that by yourself. You know, take this big poster and make a stamp in the least number of cuts. And you had to program it. And all you really had to do was just turn the paper around and stack it up. That was fun stuff. Plus, it was a chance to socialize and learn from other people. Not just about the binding work, but also about life. But one of the things, you know, the apprenticeship really does is it teaches you how to work, how to be able to complete core tasks, work with a variety of materials, basically all of them, in a production environment. And it's a requisite for moving on, period. If you didn't really have that, you weren't going to succeed. So, you know, after, as you got close to your the end of your apprenticeship, and in 3-year apprenticeship, you had a midterm after your second year, and if there were problems, then supposedly you would address them there. I was able to do mine in 2 years rather than 3 because of having been a work study student and having come in with a good number of skills already. I mean, the thing you have to understand is that when you're an apprentice, initially you're costing the shop money in the training that they have to invest in you. So if you've got skills already and they don't have to explain as much, you're making money for them sooner. So anyways, I was able to finish it in 2 years rather than 3. And in the medieval system, in the guild system as it existed there, it's very, at the end, it's very celebratory. So they have this big, you have your examinations, so you have all the apprentices in the region, the district, or whatever you want to call it, working on their projects together, and not necessarily, you know, individually, but in one big room. You're being supervised, you had a written test and stuff. And then you get a diploma, and then you also get this little thing, which is your certificate, which you're supposed to then fold up, keep in your pocket, and take with you when you're applying for jobs. And you hand this to your, you know, to the master of the shop that you want to work in, and you say, you know, it has my grades on it. It says satisfactory. But, you know, it's like, oh, okay, and this is where you worked with, and, yeah, we'll check your references. But after your apprenticeship, what you then did is you were supposed to go out and wander. And the wandering journeyman, I mean, that's where journeyman comes from, has a really, really long tradition. And it's during that period that you really start to assimilate things from all these other environments that you're working in and kind of develop your own identity, if you will. It's also when, you know, you can start after 2 years, you can, or 3 years, you can start thinking about becoming a master, opening up your own shop. If you didn't have a master title, you could not open up your own shop or train apprentices at the time. The title did not just reflect your standing as a craftsman, it also it was a legal standing. And as part of the training for that, it included accounting. It included apprentice law. You know, what can you do to your apprentices? What can't you do to them? You know, basic business practices, all that stuff. Because it's in the guild's interest, if you pass, to succeed and to continue the tradition of training people. So, yes. So then after I completed my apprenticeship, that was in the summer of 1987, I ended up going to the Centro del Bel Libro in Ascona, Switzerland, which was absolute heaven. And then, you know, after that, came back to the States, did some internships, worked in Chicago, and then Yale, Cornell, and then finally went to Syracuse, where I've been since 1995. But let's talk about Ascona. Ascona, oh, heaven. Germany that last year was absolutely miserable. It never got above 50. It's kind of like Central New York on a bad year. Never got above 50, rained constantly, dreary. And when we were heading down with a friend of the families, and we were driving down, and all through Germany it was that way. Most of Switzerland it was that way. And then we went up the San Bernardino Pass, not through the tunnel, the old way, up the Serpentines. We got to the top, clear blue skies, warm breezes, and signs that said Riviera, which didn't necessarily mean the Riviera on the Mediterranean coast. It was a small town by the name of Riviera, but the ambiance is the same. That picture there, that's of Ascona, and even when I left there, it was in November, it was still incredibly mild. You could go swimming in the lake, palm trees, everything. It was just heaven. And in Ascona, there's a school for bookbinding and conservation. Then they offer basically week-long, two-week-long courses. They had a fairly well-developed conservation program that I was fortunate enough to be able to go through the whole thing, and that was a sequence of four or five courses, each lasting about 2 to 3 weeks. So, you know, we were working in it, learning. It's very international. And, you know, we'd be working on real conservation work and learning how to do that. So that was, you know, the apprenticeship gave the foundation in terms of the skill sets to be able to start thinking about this kind of work. So what did we have? We had chemistry. For the first time, I actually understood some chemistry because we did little skits and we were all molecules and atoms and we bonded and we broke apart and we did all this other fun stuff. We did paper conservation. The picture's up there. That's, you know, we're supposed to bring our own books, so I kind of hit up all my relatives and said, okay, do you have any worthwhile old books? Don't give me this brittle stuff. But, you know, so we did washing, deacidification, we did leaf casting, we did paper splitting, neat things like that. In a leather binding conservation course, we learned how to dye leather, how to work with it, learned historic end bands, some of which we did today. Wooden boards course. So in the book, in the picture down at the bottom there, that binding, it's one that my father dug out of a dumpster in Rome. It's early 16th century or mid-16th century, but it only had one of the catches on the binding. You know, that's this part right here. Everything else was missing. So we had a course on making clasps. So, you know, you get the brass stock. How do you match it? What do they look like? What are some of the historical patterns? Vellum binding, and you know, it was wonderful. It was incredibly intensive, very hands-on, but also very practical. And you know, there's still a lot from that experience that I'm able to not necessarily apply in a hands-on context anymore, but I've done it. I know how it's supposed to work. I can talk about it to an extent. And that was, for me, that was a really, really worthwhile experience. Then, you know, came back and, well, you know, kind of have to find a job. One of the things I was fortunate enough to be able to do was to, even while I was over there, was to arrange it for an internship at the Folger Shakespeare Library, working with Frank Mowry. And that was, I mean, the Folger Shakespeare, they have an incredible collection. They have a very well-developed conservation lab. Frank knows an awful lot. The paper conservator there is very good. And so for me, that was a continuation of that training. It was also a way to switch from Monastery Hill Bindery, where I'd worked in Chicago shortly before that, to working with Bill Minter, who had a small shop also in Chicago, the conservation studio. But we had some amazing stuff come through. We worked on, you know, the big double elephant folio of Audubon's Birds of America for a collector. Nuremberg Chronicle. It was a lot of colleges, collectors from throughout the whole Midwest area who would send us their things. So for me, if I look back on my career in terms of where did I do the best work and where did I have the most fun learning, it was with Bill in Chicago, which, you know, given that it's been quite a while, I think says something. If working with him was an incredibly challenging experience, and Bill had this one, he still has this wonderful way that you've seen at the Guild Standards Conference. Well, have you thought about doing it this way? And it just makes you think. Except sometimes when you're doing something, you don't want to think. You got to get through it. You know it's not going quite the way it should. And anyway, but working with him was probably the best thing I was able to do in my career, in terms of the work experience. And then, decided it was time to get a job with real benefits and ended up at Yale. Came to Cornell where I was working as the rare books conservator and basically was seduced by digital technology. And also realized that if I was going to be able to, even as a conservator, bench conservator, any of the job ads that you saw posted were requiring an MLS. So I was like, okay, got to get the union card. So Syracuse actually offered me the ultimate work study job, meaning that they had a library school, they had remitted tuition, and they wanted to set up a conservation lab. So I was able to go there, set up that lab, work as a conservator, get my MLS, and over the years since 95, when you work in that kind of environment, your career changes sometimes. And so started getting more and more involved with digital, putting digitization projects, working on the web, things like that. Was able to hire an assistant conservator first to pick up the slack, because otherwise, why are you paying me my salary to run the conservation lab? We can outsource these things. And then, also just do more management type things. So, and that's mostly what I'm doing these days. Coming to Cornell and to Syracuse is also a move away from support systems in some respects, because when I was working in Chicago, when I was working at Yale, there was an incredible denseness of book people in those areas. At Yale, an hour up the road, I'm in East Hampton, Northampton. That's pretty hard to beat. Chicago, we had that. There was personal networking, there was a lot of collegiality. Coming here, when I came here, there was almost nothing. In terms of, if you were in Ithaca, the people that were working in the lab, that was it. There might have been someone at Rochester. When I came here, there wasn't. There wasn't anyone at Syracuse, Binghamton, or anything like that. You were very, very isolated. And that was something I needed to deal with in my own way. But I'll get back to that. So, the fun stuff, exhibitions and creative bindings. I mean, that's something that a lot of conservators get involved with. It's a way for us to challenge ourselves a little bit more aesthetically sometimes. It's an opportunity to do something a little different, and something that I really, really enjoy doing. My first experience with an exhibit was as an apprentice, and they had the National Guild had an apprentice competition every year. And I didn't bring the book, but that was a reality check, because, I looked at this book and was like, this looks really good. And got this note back, and one of the things, let's see, the scores weren't great, but there's things like, it's really clunky. Like, what do you mean? I was looking, I said, well, the book's this thick. Well, my boards are almost half the thickness of it. That's what we did. And that was the style that, as an apprentice, I was working in. Okay, I can see that. Okay, my title is a little crooked. It's that little book at the top there, the purple one. A little crooked. But that was an eye-opener. And it was kind of fun. And it's not something I had the opportunity to do again, but when I came to Chicago, there was a group that was, at the time, very active. Right now, I'd say it's on life support. And it's also changed a lot. There's an exhibit. Let's do something. So had some exhibits with Chicago Hand Bookbinders, then also got very much involved through Frank Meyer with the Guild of Bookworkers. And with absolutely no previous experience, became exhibitions chair and was told to, well, we just had a national exhibit, so in about 2 years' time, the next one needs to be on the road. Okay. How do I do that? What do I need to do? And so that was fun. And then, in terms of my work, if I were aesthetically to look at bookbinding traditions. I think the one that I'm most drawn to is Art Deco French binding. Aesthetically, it just knocks your socks off. And, you know, in the German tradition, it's a little bit more conservative. Then there's also the English tradition, which I was never really... I wouldn't say I was connected with the French tradition, but it's what I loved. It's what I wanted to be. But I kept coming back to the German tradition that I was trained in. And, you know, a lot of the materials that are used on bindings are paper, you know, the usual stuff, cloth, leather, vellum. Paper bindings, little case bindings, are something that are very often, they're overlooked. They're not as glamorous as a full leather binding with onlays and toolings and things like that, but to do one very well is very difficult. So it's like what we call the millimeter binding here, and there's a number of them shown there. You know, the structures, a lot of them are based on the case bindings. Vellum in the German tradition was used a lot. And then there's that little spring back, that account book that I learned as an apprentice. And that's something that's always kind of been a fascination of mine. It's a very mechanical kind of contraption. And it's something that you can play with. And we can look, you know, this is an exhibition catalog that I did as a spring back binding. And you can, you know, you can kind of get away from the clunky account book style and do something with it. And then there's also, you know, paste papers. I love making paste papers, and all the paste papers that you see on these books are ones that I made myself. And then also historic end bands. That's kind of what I used to do for relaxation. You sit in front of the TV and just tie a few. It's true. And some of the high points for me, when I was working with Bill in Chicago, the Grolier Club in New York City, in, together with the Grill Guild, organized an exhibit of contemporary American bookbinding. That was the first exhibition of modern American binding to travel to Europe. Not artist books, because Center for Book Arts did something similar to that. But, you know, fine binding going to France. You know, the French tradition is like, oh boy. Okay, how's this going to go over there? And it went over fairly well, but the Dante that I have in there, which was probably the third binding I did for an exhibit, was accepted into that show, went to Paris, went to Brussels, and that for me was, that was very, very motivating. A little bit after that, Jan Sobota, who's a Czech binder, who was working at the time in, I think he was either in Cleveland or he'd gone down to the Bridwell, but a friend of his, who's a printmaker, Ladislav Hanka, they decided to get together and do a set book invitational exhibit. So there were four titles, and 25 binders were invited to bind one of those four titles, but you had to bind two copies. And that's something that's happens sometimes. And what happens is that you get to keep one of the copies, but the printer got to keep the other one. And so now there's this collection of 25 bindings at Western Michigan State University or something like that, which is where he gave his papers. And so that was kind of neat. It's like, okay, I was invited to participate in this. You know, I hadn't thought of myself in that way. And then, you know, there's an exhibit in Chicago, the second National Book and Paper Arts Biennial. I think they've done it four times now since. And those are probably the most artist booky type things I have ever done, and I haven't done anything like it since. They were a lot of fun. They're both here. The book itself, it's an alphabet book that we did initially. Torsten Dennerlein, who's a printmaker and friend of mine, and I did for a Guild of Bookworkers ABC book exhibit. And that was a fun project. I wrote to him and I said, Torsten, we want to do this alphabet book. You know, we've talked about doing something together. He said, sure, how do you want to do it? Batted ideas back and forth. And what we decided to do was randomly pick, each of us would pick out random words out of the dictionary, put them in a hat, and then pick out the 26 that would work best. And it's a really, really odd selection of words. And he did all the illustrations, and then I ended up binding the edition. It was done in edition of 10. And then there was, he had a copy, I had a copy, and I ended up buying a copy. But, you know, that was a collaborative project, and I'm not really big on accordions. I know they're incredibly popular structures. I'm not really big on them. So after this, I said, Torsten, no more accordions, please. But it worked out really well. For me, I thought it was a really good challenge to just kind of get away from the codex, get away from what I had been doing, and kind of stretch myself a little bit. By saying I haven't done anything like that since, that doesn't mean I've retreated, but, you know, I haven't really had the creative energy to do something like that. So the one is the accordion, the one the TV set down below is, it's a board book. And when I do presentations for art students at Syracuse, you know, I show them a lot of structures that they can use and develop in their own work. And very often those tend to be simple. So I'll show them accordions. I'll show them flag books. I show them children's books. And if you look at the board book, kiddie board book, you know, you've got these really thick pages. The spine drops down nicely. It opens flat. And because of the way I was working the edition and because of his inconsistency between the two sheets, I put a crease through one of them, and I realized, oops, this is off, and had to remeasure. So as a conservator, I could pretty much get rid of that crease. But it would, as an accordion fold, it would never work. So that was the one I ended up getting for myself. And I decided, well, the board book structure would work. So that was kind of fun doing it in full leather. And then the TV is, there's one of the words in there is television. And so I took that illustration, and the box for that is the TV set. And then the other thing was the Society of Bookbinders competition in 2003, and I'd done this book and really didn't think that much of it, but the English, you know, picked a German binding to give an award for forwarding. That was kind of fun. And that was an award that I shared with a colleague of mine from California who did something similar. And so that was fun. And then, you know, a lot of what I also do in the past few years has been teaching. Did a lot of workshops. I tend to focus on my core skill set, so the case binding and millimeter binding, vellum on boards. I love working with vellum, and it's not a material that sees an awful lot of use. I mean, you see people doing limp vellum bindings, but the vellum on boards, people are afraid of it. And part of that is it's a reasonable phobia, but because vellum is extremely hygroscopic, meaning it reacts to changes in temperature and humidity fairly violently, and that tends to scare them off. Then things like the springback, paste papers, and then, you know, the historic end bands. And a lot of that also been working with the Guild of Bookworkers as exhibitions chair, and then also writing up some of these tutorials and things like that. And then there's these other ventures, and that gets back to the isolation of Central New York. Actually, that's something else. But with the Guild of Bookworkers, you know, why start small? And that was, for me, that was a real challenge, organizing an exhibit of 60-plus bindings that was going to travel throughout the country, fundraising, finding venues, working with jurors. I mean, that's a lot for basically a committee of one to do. And in the end, I also ended up producing the catalog because the designer that we had hired for that, for whatever reason, said, I don't have time for this, I'm out. And that was with, you know, I think I had something like 3 weeks to get it to the printers. So I'd just gotten a computer, I was using WordPerfect 5.1, and it shows, but the catalog got out, the color reproductions are really good, and I was happy. And then shortly thereafter, we did Fine Printers, finally, well, that was the exhibit, and then Paper Bound, which was a set book exhibit where 26 of us bound the same book as on handmade papers. And then again, so by that time, working, you know, finding venues had come a lot easier. I was also publicity and public relations chair for the Guild, something which I enjoyed. And part of it was bringing the Guild online. And that's really, if I think about my work and my place, it's not so much in the bindings. I mean, I have, you know, don't take this the wrong way, but I haven't really sold many fine bindings. Actually, I haven't sold any. And I don't necessarily want to sell them. I haven't done that many commissions for people, although I've done a fair number. It's been something that I've done for me. But you know, the biggest thing that I think that I've done is, and it has to do with also with bringing the Guild online, was when I, you know, when I came to, oh, it's still the Guild, never mind. And then this past year, came back out of retirement and was asked to organize the Guild's 100th anniversary exhibition, which was a really, really monumental task that basically burned me out for about a year and a half afterwards. I'm still feeling some of that. But that was organizing a juried exhibition, which was got the biggest response we've ever gotten, curating a retrospective, working with catalog production, doing the fundraising, things like that. But for me, you know, just looking back, it's a nice opportunity, having had this break, to get back into it again. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, you know, for some time, this has not been my primary occupation, has not been the binding of the books. That's been something I've been doing for myself. And doing the Guild 100th, you know, I'm starting to enjoy that experience. But, you know, the other things that I've done, like I said, when I came to Cornell, I lost my support system. And at the time, for conservation, there was a gentleman by the name of Walter Henry at Stanford who had a list, wasn't really a discussion, but it was a distribution list for conservation things. And they had some books, book conservation topics, but not really anything with more creative. But you're saying, well, why don't you start something and talk to your systems people? Maybe they have a listserv or something at Cornell. I'm sure they do. So started it, and within about a year and a half, I was at about 1,000 people. Now we're over 2,000. But that's really become a way for people everywhere to communicate. I mean, the audience is really, it's worldwide. I think in many respects, if I look at, I mean, there's a lot of other lists other than the one I started, but this one is still, for whatever reason, the most heavily trafficked. But what you've seen is, in terms of the print publications like the Guild newsletter, a lot of the things that used to come out in that are now just strictly online. It's exhibitions announcements, calls for entries, workshops. How do I do this? And as more and more people got online, it also, in some respects, not just the Book Arts -L, but also some of these others, they've become the primary training for a lot of people getting into the book arts. It's the first place people look, you know, the internet has become the first place a lot of people come to look for information on bookbinding, on book arts. And every once in a while, you kind of have to remind them, it's like, you know, yes, it's a good place to start, but some of the best information doesn't exist there. It's still in print. And, you know, it's, you have to work at it from the craft angle. A year later, when I came to Syracuse and started doing web stuff, started a website for book arts resources, and Michelle kind of mentioned it, but you know, there's images and things like that, but there's also links to binders pages, programs, exhibits, tutorials that people are publishing. And it's kind of developed a life of its own. People ask me, fair enough, like, how do you find time to do it? It's, you know, you're at this point, since it grew so organically, you're just adding a little bit to it every once in a while. But, you know, there's a desire to maybe change it, do something different. Then a couple of, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, started an online publication called The Bone Folder with a number of colleagues, and that's really grown a little bit as well. And that was, you know, the impetus for that was a workshop that we had at Syracuse in the library on open access journals. Like, wait a minute, we could do this. So we did. It's kind of fun. And then, you know, so what am I doing? I think, you know, for me, a lot of it is refocusing on binding projects, aiming towards exhibits, but also doing other things. I have a whole pile of books and sheets, some of them, most of them letterpress, some of them very nice. Just kind of working my way through that. I really enjoy teaching, mentoring people, and have colleagues throughout the country who I've communicated with over the years. Some of them I've never met, but you know, there was a woman who was in a degree, graphic design degree program at Syracuse Independent Study, who emailed me, actually met her once, and she said, well, can you know, you show me how to do this? And it's like, well, how's this going to work virtually? And you know, sending pictures and just communicating, you know, you really have an opportunity to develop some lasting relationships that way, and that's been really fun. And then just, you know, refocusing, and I mean, I do like the online component. It's kind of fun. And but it's also, you know, I've been doing it for 10 plus years, and maybe time to move on, but every time I think it's going to die, it doesn't. And every time somebody starts a new list or something like that, I really hope it'll take off, and some do, some don't, but who knows. And then, you know, at some point, because of some of the tutorials that I've written, you know, I thought, well, maybe there's room to publish a manual or something like that. And then I think, does the world really need another manual? So who knows? But you know, a big question is the field of the book arts. You know, the traditional craft experience, the traditional craft training, finding those opportunities is becoming more and more limited. Most of the workshops that are offered are fairly basic. The advanced workshops, which is what I'd consider most of the ones that I've taught, the venues don't say, you can give them prerequisites. We would love everybody who's taking this workshop to be able to do a case binding before you think about doing it in spring back or something. They don't enforce that. They can't because of their economics. So you see a lot of people with no previous experience coming in, which can have, I don't want to say a dumbing down effect, but it really makes it harder to work on the finer points. But, you know, the really, if you want to learn gold tooling, try to find a workshop on that. There's maybe one every couple of years somewhere. But there's also no demand for it commercially. I mean, real hand tooling, per se. And the people who have those skills, they're all dying out. They're retiring. And unless you can exercise those skills continually, you will never develop the proficiency to successfully pass it on, because you won't feel comfortable enough yourself to train them how to do that. I mean, I could never teach a workshop on gold tooling. I learned it. I can tell you theoretically what to do. Stick a tool in my hand and it's like, no, not going to happen. But, you know, there's, in the past 10 years or so, I would say, you know, looking at organizations like the Guild of Bookworkers, membership has increased by about a quarter to a third. There's more and more book art centers and workshops that are being offered. A lot of people are coming into it. And those people, by and large, you know, they want to do it as something else. Some people think, well, you know, I'm working as a systems analyst, a computer programmer, what have you, I would love to go back and learn a craft. And, you know, there's a lot to be said for that, but it's, you know, I think what I would tell most of them is, do it because you want to, do it because it's therapeutic, do it to create nice things for yourself. If you feel this urge to try to, you know, participate in exhibitions or something like that, go for it. But in terms of a career, you're not going to be able to do it really making journals, things like that, which is what most people want to do. You know, you look at articles, and you know, as I was thinking about back on what I've been doing for this talk, and also in the context of some other things, you know, a lot of the headlines and articles and newspaper clippings and things like that, it's like a lost art, a dead art, you know, finding the lost link or whatever. I think that's more than a little overdone. I think book arts, bookbinding are far from dead. I think all this renewed energy and this influx of people can do nothing but good for it, but it's going to be a very different field. The traditional binding, like I like to do, like I learned, is probably going to become a smaller and smaller part of it. And what's going to be a larger part is going to be the more conceptual, the artist books, you know, if you want to call it that, and that's a whole different discussion, but more organic, more free-flowing structures. And I think that's the direction that's going to go in. And the book arts, bookbinding has changed over the years. And in my opinion, until fairly recently in the history of the book, it has never really been an art per se. It's been a craft where there's been expressions of art in the design, but it's been a trade. It's been a container for texts, first and foremost. And if you were the Duke of so-and-so and wanted to have a really ornate one, well, then you got it. But by and large, they were fairly simple, utilitarian. And it's only been, I think, in the past 200 years or so that it's become much more creative. And in the greater scheme of things, that's not that long. And things evolve, and that's fine. So I'd like to think that there's a future. It's just going to be a very different future. And so what I'd like to invite you all to do is, A, if you have any questions for me, and then also to come up, and I'm happy to talk about some of the examples that I brought of my work. So, thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Well, it's interesting. Whenever I think about the future of hand bookbinding or book arts, and I start to think more about e-books, I wonder, as time goes on, I work on the web primarily now also. So I think about, if at some point, I don't think that e-books are ever going to replace printed books, but I wonder if at some point, if they become popular enough, that the idea of paying something to get a hand-bound copy, a nice hand-bound copy of a book is going to become more necessary sometime way in the future. And almost kind of rolling back to the idea of what bookbinding started out as. So I don't know. I don't know if that's what's going to happen, but it's something that seems like it.
I mean, if you look at, the allied arts like printmaking, letterpress printing, I think there's always going to be a book.
Yeah.
I don't think the e-book is going to replace it, not even close. But it's going to be a very different audience for them. It might become more of a fetish object. Maybe not. But it's going to be interesting to see. And then there's also, how can the e-book be melded with the traditional binding? I mean, we talk about things like electronic paper. Well, gee, if I've got this, can I make a binding for it? I mean, there's binders out there working with all sorts of funky materials, mylar, polypropylene, plexi, what have you, and those aren't even that funky anymore. Why couldn't you do design binding on an e-book? And so, I mean, Jim Brockman did one, and I think he did this in the 70s, that had all sorts of buttons and lights on it, and I forget what the title of it was, but for the time, it was totally electronic, plexiglass, and run a traditional book. I mean, why not? Why not flip it?
I mean, even CDs, I see this kind of movement now with fans that are more interested in the kind of tactile experience that I guess you see it with record albums. That I see a lot of handmade books and inserts and
right.
covers.
And the thing is, the skill sets in hand bookbinding, I don't necessarily, at least in the traditional apprenticeship model that I went through, it wasn't just binding books that we learned how to do, it was making boxes, making portfolios, any number of those what can be very mundane utilitarian structures, but the skills that you get, even if you don't practice them, it's like, oh wow, okay, I can make a CD case. I could, they're there, and there's a lot of people, even with different training experience, who have those skills, who can think their way through it and come up with enclosures for just about anything. And that's fun. I mean, that can be a really fun part of it. You just have to think less about the codex and putting cover on a text block and just kind of get outside the box.
There was a point where you said that you became interested in the digital.
Mm-hmm.
And can you talk a little bit about how you went from one to the other? What what kind of programs you started using, what for, outcome of that?
I would say I was first, my first exposure to UMA was working at Yale, and Yale and Cornell at the time were working on a cooperative project, I believe, where Yale was digitizing microfilm and Cornell was going to output from digital to microfilm, something like that. And I got a whiff of that when I was working at Yale. When I came here, you know, Ann Kenny was doing her thing. So it was really fascinating just to talk to the people and see what was going on. When I came to Syracuse, in special collections and preservation, I was pretty much it in terms, I mean, in 1995, the web was totally new. When I came to Syracuse to the library, we didn't even have a website yet. We didn't have a website until like 1996. Part of library school was learning about it, how to put pages online. Then David Stamm, who was the director of the library there, encoded archival description was coming into it, which is used for manuscript collection finding aids. So I got sent off to that training. And then there were some other workshops. I took the digital imaging workshop here at Cornell. And it just started becoming, it was a very organic process. It wasn't abrupt. I was still doing the conservation lab, but now I'm doing the web pages for special collections and preservation. Oh, now I'm going to take these scanned files and run OCR on them and put that online, and now we're going to put pictures online. So it was always very fluid. And, you know, even in the context of my work in special collections right now, there's a lot that I'm doing, like with, we're working on creating a database for all the images that are created for patron requests, so like the stuff that's created through DCAPS here. Can we create a database and maybe put some of those things online? But it's still always involved with the conservation lab still reports to me, with the preservation side of things, managing the collections, things like that.
So does it involve design?
You mean graphic design?
Yeah.
I would say at a fairly basic level. And on our library's website, there's really not a lot of opportunity for that because we have a library-wide template that we use for digital projects that are in Content DM. There's a library-wide template that we use. So no, in terms of the graphic design, there really isn't anything. And I wouldn't call myself a terribly hip web designer. I mean, I'd say most of what I do is fairly dated. But it's a nice way to put things out there and share them. And you know, if you're sharing, whether it's book arts or exhibits of holdings that you have, you can reach a much wider audience than you could if you were either didn't have any kind of record of the exhibit or did a print catalog. Sometimes we do both. But it's a really good tool for publicizing. And I put the emphasis on tool. Yes?
Would you mind explaining the difference between a cover binding and a millimeter binding?
You mean a case binding and a millimeter binding?
Case binding, yes.
In a case binding, basically, and I don't have an example of a model here, but a case binding, the text block is constructed and then the cover is constructed off the book. The millimeter binding, what it has is, that's the American term for it. It basically has leather or parchment trim that's either just at the head caps and the tail caps, along the fore edges. And the direct translation from the German is kind of more a nobler paper case binding. So it's a way of decor, and I have, 1, 2, 3, like 6 or 7 of them here that you can take a look at. And it's a way to, in the German tradition, using paste papers in particular, more so than marble papers, and then as to cover bindings, and then using the leather trim, it's a really nice, simple but elegant binding. And it's interesting to see when you have international competitions or exhibitions to see those entered, and then I have 2 posters in my office, the Infinito one, and then the St. Francis, which are big international exhibitions, and have all the bindings of like the winners on the poster, and how well a very simple paste paper covered binding with leather trim somewhere can compete with a very ornately tooled binding. And they're very different aesthetics. Structurally and technically, I mean, the paper case and the one with the millimeter is much, much simpler, but it's also a difficult binding to do very, very well. You know, so you can, you know, take a look and talk about it some more.
Okay.
You can see in examples. Yeah.
I saw a picture of you using PVA in one of your early pictures. Have you, in your type of training, has synthetic adhesives just totally replaced animal glue, or is that?
Everything has its place. In that earlier picture, it was probably us doing fan gluing as an apprentice or something. I mean, that's what you want to use when you're doing library binding, you're doing fan gluing, you need to use a PVA. You can't do it with high glue, really. Use a lot of paste. You know, if I'm doing my own work, I tend to use a lot of paste. I do use gelatin/hide glue. I love using it for making boxes because, in contrast to PVA, you can sand it. If you try to sand PVA, it's a film, it pills, it skims off, you know. The hide glue goes in. It's a question of knowing how to use it and using it right. And it's a material that, in this country and certain conservation communities, I think for good reasons, on the whole, is in disrepute. But more of that has to do with how it's used and misused than the base material itself. You know, if you leave that hide glue, even if you start out with pure food grade gelatin like I do, if you leave it in your glue pot too long, it burns, it gets dark, it becomes very acidic. If you slop it on your spine of your book really thick, it's going to be really brittle. If you have a really thin film on it, it's incredibly flexible. So it's learning how to use the materials. But I think for good reason, especially how it was misused in the trade, it has gone into disrepute. But I think it's important not to, unless there's a really, really good reason, not to rule out or not to eliminate anything from your toolkit just because. And I think everything has its place. I think it's important to feel comfortable using them sometimes. I don't have it mixed up all the time, but if I have a reason for it, I'll make up some small batch. I don't have to worry about it.
Can you look now?
Yeah, go for it.
This has been a production of the Cornell University Library.